Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello, and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim White, and I'm joined by my dad, John White. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And this is a kind of unexpected follow-on, really, to our last episode, which was all about egg freezing. So if you haven't listened to that, please do pause this episode and go back and have a listen. But in response to our discussion around why increasing numbers of women are choosing to freeze their eggs and some of the kind of cultural, social drivers of that, including from Christian women, we've had a few interesting emails from listeners talking about how their own experience of this issue, or from kind of friends of theirs, is driven primarily by the supposed lack of kind of suitable male partners, boyfriends, and ultimately husbands they're finding in church circles, and this coming back to this basic idea, which has been around for a while, but that there is a fundamental gender gap in the church, as it's sometimes called, that there are more significantly more women than men attending church, getting stuck in, taking their faith seriously, and this has had the inevitable but unfortunate consequence that there is a kind of surplus of single women who would like to be married but just simply cannot find suitable partners. Is this an idea that you've come across before, Dad?
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's not a new idea. I think it's something that's been recognized probably for hundreds of years, certainly ever since I was a young man. It seemed that there was a definite imbalance in the number of committed young women who were in church circles, involved in Christian unions and other Christian activities, compared with the number of men. And I mean, for instance, it's always been known that the number of single lady missionaries, people who, cross-cultural missionaries who left the rich countries and went to low-resource countries, many of them single women who were often pioneers and did remarkable things. But I think it's a reality which has been there for a long time, and it's an interesting question as to why that should be. But I'm fast forwarding to the present. I'm well aware of a number of young Christian women in their 20s, 30s, 40s, single, who would love to find a partner, would love to raise a family, and yet they simply find it impossible to find someone who they could get married to, who they feel is suitable within the Christian community.
Yeah, it's certainly a kind of trope, I would say, of particularly among evangelicals, a kind of discussion for as long as I can remember. I have to say, when I hear this discussed, kind of alarm bells ring in the back of my head about how much is this anecdotally true versus being actually true. And so I think it's one of those things which is almost like taken for granted. But in that sense, people often don't probe into is there actual data and evidence to suggest that this is more than just anecdotally true. So I did a very brief kind of Google search to see what kind of surveys had been done. Unfortunately, most of the data does, as often is the case, comes from America. But I think we can probably suggest that here in our context in the UK, there's going to be slightly similar dynamics at play. So according to the well-respected Pew Research Organization, when you ask people to kind of state their religion by gender, when you look at evangelical Protestantism, the tradition that we both come from, there is a slight bias towards women. It's about 55% to 45%. 55% of people who describe themselves as Protestants are women, 45% men. So a slight imbalance, but hardly overwhelming. But actually, I guess the more potent or interesting question is not just that's just about affiliation, as people will be familiar with, you know, when you ask people in surveys what faith you have, much larger numbers of people will call themselves Christians than would actually be kind of meaningfully practicing that faith. And a more useful proxy of that would be kind of regular church attendance. So there's been different answers when you look at this question. But again, in the States, when you aggregate kind of several studies together, in evangelical Protestant churches, apparently it suggests that there are approximately, for every 100 women there are attending church, there are about 93 men. So again, a noticeable difference. And this is actually similarly across all religious traditions. So another Pew research I looked at said that about 40% of women said that they attended a religious service at least once a week in America versus 32% of men. And this is fascinatingly actually along all measures of religious commitment. This is replicated globally too. So Pew said that in 54 countries where data was collected on Christians' daily prayer habits, Christian women report praying daily more frequently than Christian men by an overall average gap of 10 percentage points. I.e., when you look around 54 different countries around the world and ask people, how often do you pray? How do you pray every day? On average, there are 10 percentage points lead for women saying yes to men. And in some of those countries, it could be as big as a gap as 25 percentage points. And I think it's interesting to me because my instinct is often to be, this debate about gender gap in church can be kind of a proxy for some other discussions about complementarianism. But actually, I think the evidence is clear that it's not simply anecdotal. There is definitely more women coming to church than men, more women taking their faith seriously than men in terms of kind of personal spirituality and discipleship as well, although the gap may not be as vast as is sometimes portrayed.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I mean, I would just put a huge question mark about American statistics compared to European statistics because, I mean, as is well known, religiosity in the States is enormous compared to the secular Europe. And so 33% of men attending church is laughable, isn't it? I mean, here, you know, regular church attenders would be, what, 5%? It's tiny. Like so, you know, whereas social church going is still in large swathes of middle America, this is still a...
Mm. There was one survey I found on the UK which said across all churches and denominations on average, this was at church attendance just once a month rather than once a week, it was 4.4% of male adults in Great Britain attended church once a month, while 5.2% of women, which might seem obviously small, but if you look at them, the two numbers in comparison, that means that, you know, there's about a quarter more women than men, which... Yeah, they say so, if you across the population, that amounts to about 500,000 more women than men in the church. This is in the UK.
Yes, and I think also if you just sort of draw back and you say what aspects is it of a living Christian faith which attract men and women, I think, again, this is anecdotal, but I think more women are attracted to the contemplative, prayerful aspects of Christianity. I mean, for instance, I'm just thinking of at the church I go to, there is a regular quiet day which is advertised as a day of contemplative prayer for, and it's made open to the church congregation at all. And it is overwhelmingly women. I mean, almost 8-1, something like that, in terms of women versus men who choose to go on a contemplative, on a day of contemplative and quiet prayer. So I think often men are drawn by the being part of a team, being part of a group, and often by a kind of activism, the activism of church engagement, you know, generalizations. But I think there, this is, and probably you could trace that back, couldn't you, to back to centuries, to just differences. And again, what the root of these differences are, I'm not by any means confident that I know. But whatever the reasons are, I think there is a there are differences. Actually, just I'm going off a slightly tangent. As you know, I've recently published a book on friendship, and as a result of that, I did a study just looking at friendship, you know, through the Bible. And one of the things that really struck me is that when Jesus says, you know, you are my friends, he says that to the disciples, all males, all gathered in the upper room. As far as we know, the females weren't there. And they then proceed to betray his friendship in a spectacular way, literally within hours. I mean, when it's framed in the Old Testament understanding of friendship, it's all about kind of covenant loyalty. And a friend is one who prepares to sacrifice. Greater love has no one than to give their life for their friends. And yet, all the men turn tail and run. And yet, there is a subversive tale within the Gospels, and that is that Jesus does have loyal friends, and they're all the women. It's the women who turn up. It's the women who go to the cross and take the risk of being associated with him. It's the women who work out where he is buried. It's the women who prepare spices. It's the Holy Saturday. It's the women who go to the grave before dawn. It's the women who are witnesses to the resurrection. So there's a kind of subversive plot that who are Jesus's loyal friends? And answer, it's not the men. It's a whole group of women. And, you know, so there is the fact that there are gender differences that is already being spelt out in the New Testament.
And I think this points to something that's a really interesting paradox, tension potentially in kind of church history, which is that, you know, Christianity is a faith started by a man, Jesus, and his 12 male disciples, and has been disproportionately led by you know, men. In most traditions, exclusively reserved kind of church leadership for men for most of church history. And yet, for centuries, the core people who actually practice the faith, who keep these churches going through their voluntary service, have been women. And so there's this fascinating tension where you would have predicted that Christianity would become a faith built in the image of the men who led, started, and lead it. And yet the argument sometimes goes, well, there's this this gender gap. That's because the church has become too feminized. And I guess the question I'm interested in is, okay, we have a gender gap. We have a church that is disproportionately female. Whose fault is that? Or is it anyone's fault? Is this because the women, like those first disciples, are just better at being Christians, are just better at, institutionally better at following Jesus and taking risks and making sacrifices and responding to the call? Or is it actually the men would like to be Christians, would like to be part of church, but actually church has become too feminized, and therefore the men are kind of put off? And, you know, this is where you often hear the kind of usual tropes about, you know, we need more preaching about Old Testament heroes, or, you know, we need different to sing different songs that aren't kind of Jesus is my boyfriend, but are kind of like manly fighting songs about onward Christian soldiers. And, you know, you even read people saying, you know, well, look, you know, male leadership in the church is all about wearing dresses and silly hats and special pectoral crosses, and it's all deeply emasculating. And you know, we shouldn't be surprised that men don't turn up when to turn up, you know, to be a Christian, that all the kind of role models they see are of these kind of soft-handed you know, effeminate pretty boys singing about how Jesus is their boyfriend. And this is, so, as you can tell, this is a line of argument that I find kind of unpersuasive, but I think you have to acknowledge that is, I mean, there are entire ministries here in the UK and even more in the States dedicated to this premise that churches need to be taught how to be more kind of male friendly, be more less emotional, more rugged and individualistic and masculine. I mean, what do you make of that?
It's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, these are very complex cultural trends. I mean, you have to acknowledge the extraordinary popularity of figures like Jordan Peterson, you know, not in a directly Christian context, but nonetheless, he's been latched on by many people on the kind of Christian right, who is basically promoting this idea, isn't it, of the feminization of the culture and the need for men to rediscover their own identity, to take responsibility, to and so on. I do think there is something in this thesis that Christianity has become masculinized. I mean, I think back to my own roots. You know, that my formative period as a young Christian was definitely in the student period in my first few years, which is when my own Christian faith came alive. And I was very, very influenced by images of, it was about total discipleship. It was about sacrifice. Operation Mobilization had recently started. George Verwer used to give these fiery talks about the need for total commitment and sacrifice. I can remember I was very influenced by the missionary martyr Jim Elliot, who was martyred in Latin America and reaching out to Amazonian tribes. And there was this great quote, "He is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." And the idea that that might lead to martyrdom was something that actually I found very attractive. It was a compelling vision of sacrificial living. I was also very influenced by the whole stories that were emerging from the persecuted church in Eastern Europe. And again, there were remarkable stories of martyrdom, of torture, of Christian faithfulness under extreme persecution, which drew me, as far from it repelling me and thinking, yuck, isn't that terrible? There was something about this extraordinary sacrificial aspects to Christianity which drew me, and was a lot to do with what, you know, of my involvement. I spent a whole summer with an organization supporting the underground church. I did other things with Operation Mobilization. And when I compare that with the kind of presentation, often the way that Christianity is presented today, it often seems that it is a kind of, you know, you're feeling bored and depressed, and if you come to Christ, you'll find meaning and purpose, and you'll find safety and security. And there's a famous quote, isn't there, from Bonhoeffer: when Christ calls a man, he bids him come and die. And Bonhoeffer often talked about cheap grace that was not sacrificial, the cheap grace that took all the nice things. of Christianity, and which didn't really resonate with the sacrificial. So I think I don't want to overstate the gender differences. You know, I know that there are, and there were, women who were equally drawn by that narrative of sacrifice and martyrdom and so on. But I think there is something about, I think it's more likely that kind is to appeal to male psychology. And I think that if the appeal of evangelical Christianity today is largely about this is where you'll find your needs met, you know, this is where you'll find purpose and meaning, I think there are an awful lot of young men out there who say, but I just don't need that. I'm not needy. I'm not got mental health issues. I'm really enjoying my life. I'm, you know, why on earth, what is there about Christianity that attracts me?
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I think there's a lot to agree with there. I think I certainly agree that a lot of our language and the way we think about Christianity and faith has become kind of therapeuticized, to mangle a word, that we kind of, which is simply a reflection of how we talk about all of life right now, which is in this kind of therapeutic mindset of, you know, everyone is feeling anxious and is feeling stressed and is struggling with their mental health and is lonely, and therefore we look at everything through the frame of how is it going to bring that kind of inner sense of peace and calm and security and wholeness that we're searching for, which is obviously a legitimate and true strand of what the gospel is about, but I think can certainly be alienating or make evangelism challenging when people don't buy into this idea that they're kind of, you know, there's a nagging ache in them inside that nothing else seems to fill, which is not the experience of a lot of people. I guess I had questions about whether gendering that experience is that helpful, whether I think there are just as many men and women in equal numbers who would feel that kind of Christianity is unappealing because they don't have a sense of deep insecurity they need fixing. I think my concerns around some of the kind of language about how do we get men back into the church and have we lost a sense of rugged adventure and risk and sacrifice is, you know, I'm all for, you know, kind of strong Christus Victor theology or, you know, calls to sacrifice and that kind of stuff. I think we could all benefit from that in the church. But I think when you read, what I struggle with when I read some of these, you know, the blogs and the kind of guidance and training about how to get men back into church, it's all about things like, you know, men struggle to sit still and listen to sermons. So make sure you have short kind of 8-minute sermons that don't have too much, you know, wishy-washy language and deep theology. Or, you know, men don't really want to come to social events. So, you know, don't, you know, you need to... you know, men aren't good at small talk and they don't want to be like stuck in a room talking to people. So, you know, you've got to make sure you go out there. And I guess not only do I find this stuff alienating because it doesn't speak to my own experience as a man, as a Christian man, but I also just find it profoundly patronizing because it basically says that men are kind of quite kind of shallow, 2D, stupid, kind of loners. And I think, you know, a lot of these stereotypes have germs of truth, but fundamentally, the instinct is, you know, men aren't coming to church. That must be the women who are already in church's fault, rather than what is it? Some is there anything the men aren't doing right? Is it actually that the men might have abiding sins and temptations that are leading them to find it difficult to respond to the call of Christ? But no, the answer is always no. Men are great as they are. Men are just fine, and it's the women who are running the church that need to change everything they're doing to try and get men into the door. And I just think it paints this incredibly kind of pastiche, kind of shallow idea of what masculinity is. Selling women short as well, because actually a lot of the, you know, a lot of women will enjoy being called to sacrifice for Jesus and to stand up for justice and, you know, seeing the gospel as an adventure and all this stuff. I'm not convinced that kind of entrenching the gendered silos is a helpful solution to the kind of gender gap.
No, I accept that, and I don't want to overstate it. I just two things occur to me. One is there is a real problem, I think, in the people who are being ordained or going for church leadership in whatever evangelical denomination, because I don't think they are representative of men in the community. Because, I think, again, and it would be interesting to try and unpack that why, but I think the job of a church leader, certainly as it is here in the UK and probably many places across the world, you know, what is the employment? What do you do when you're a church leader? Is one that is, I think, a great deal of men find unattractive. You know, why would I want to spend my life doing that? Basically giving talks and being pastoral, providing pastoral support. And so I feel there's a disconnect between the men who do all the preaching and the sort of lives they lead in the Christian bubble. Versus, it's not just the men, of course, but they are the role models. So I think that's one issue. But I think just something else that has occurred to me, and that is I've noticed over the years that when men are in the presence of women, there's a tendency for a lot of men just to feel their behavior is different from when they're alone in an all-male group. I'm sure the same is true to some extent with all-female groups, but for obvious reasons I haven't observed that. But what I have observed with men is that, and interestingly, years ago I started running some male-only quiet days, almost as a bit of an experiment. You know, why did the men not go to the female quiet days? What had tended to happen is that the female quiet days were very touchy-feely, with lots of arts and crafts and candles and express your feelings here on this piece of paper. When we did men only, it was quite different. First, the quality of the food deteriorated dramatically. It was sort of sandwiches from Tesco's as opposed to really nice food. But second, rather to my surprise, the men really wanted to share their own struggles, honestly, with other men. They wanted to talk about temptations and frustrations and their own spiritual life and share it man to man in a remarkably open way, which I rather surprised me. But it was something about this was an all-male space. And I don't know whether that was atypical. Maybe it was. Maybe, you know, I can't generalize to everyone else. But it did strike me that there was something here about all-male groups. And basically within the church as a whole, all male groups are regarded as inappropriate, antediluvian, again, that word, patriarchal.
Hmm.
You know, we should do everything together.
Yeah, this is actually something I've been thinking quite a lot about over the last few years, because my wife has been studying at a theological college, and there's a group for the spouses of students, which is ostensibly gender neutral, but in reality, for 95% of the time I've been there, it's been an exclusively women group plus me. And so I've spent more time as the sole man in an otherwise entirely female group over the last few years than I ever have before. And it's been it's a really interesting experience. I mean, primarily there's truth in what you say, in that, you know, I'm obviously not the only husband in the college, but almost all of the other men have very little interest in attending a group in which they are a massive minority. And so sometimes they come once or twice at the start of year, and then they stop coming.
This is not for me.
Not for them. It's certainly true that you observe the significances of kind of gender differences, you know, and when they do the kind of annual away day, there's often a bit of head scratching about what to do about Tim. Is he going to want a journal, which is the kind of the giddy bag that they give to everyone else, and a kind of inspirational fridge magnet Bible verse, or should we, you know, should we give him what we're giving everyone else, because that would be discriminatory not to, or should we actually try and come up with a more male friendly gift?
Give him a book about footballers.
But what is fascinating to me is one, is that once you push past that initial awkwardness about, oh my gosh, I'm the only man here, it very quickly becomes unimportant. And actually what we have in common, we're all married to people who are training for ministry and doing theological study, and we're all Christians and we're all evangelicals living in the same town, like, becomes more important. But also, what is fascinating is that for the women, it's not an unusual experience. Every single woman there has spent a lot of her life as the only woman in a male-only room, often in a work context, but also in church circles as well. Part of a PCC, or, you know, the only woman, you know, doing the admin in office or whatever like that. And there's something about how there's still a kind of male defaultedness to a lot of the circles we move in, including church and I think work circles. And so women just come to expect that there will be plenty of occasions when, because this is a male default space, I am the only woman here, but I obviously can't avoid these spaces. I have to, and they have to make their peace with being them. And I think it's fascinating to me that men don't have that experience. There's a lot of men who go their entire life and they've never been the only man in a room full of women. And so when they are thrown into that situation, they find it profoundly uncomfortable and often, frankly, flake out and say, no, I can't deal with this. It's just too awkward. And we sit back and say, isn't this interesting? Oh, how do we change things? When actually this is an experience that women have had to go through countless times and find ways of kind of making their peace with being the only women in a certain space. So I think this is interesting how we... Even in how we do this conversation, there's still a lot of unquestioned presumptions about why certain things can or should be gendered, and whether we lean into that or whether we actually want to challenge the fact that men don't like being in a room full of women. Is that something we want to kind of coddle and say, yeah, that's fine, let's find more male only spaces for you? Or is that something we want to say, actually, is that a healthy response? Or, you know, are we actually supposed to be called as Christians to be living our life as believers in mixed gender community?
Yeah, and very good questions. And I don't have a clear answer, but I can see what you're saying. Just to come back, we ought to finish soon, but just to come back to this question of single women who find, for whatever reason, they can't find a partner within the church. I've noticed a very significant rise in the use of Christian dating apps.
Definitely.
And know of people who found their Christian other half through a dating app. And I think, again, that's a kind of fascinating development. What do you think about that? I mean, if you were single and had not met your wife, and would you be going on a Christian dating app?
Good question. I mean, anecdotally, yes, it's very common. I would say approaching, by the time you get to kind of my age, so 30s, you know, I think of the people I know now who are single or kind of recently getting together as Christians, probably almost more of them than not met on apps. I think because the kind of main venue for meeting would be kind of university days and kind of church. And if you've been in the same church for 10 years and not met a husband, I think it's more common than not that people start to turn to the apps. I think I would certainly consider it. I think I have a kind of natural antipathy towards the idea of kind of manufacturing something like that, and have a kind of vague sense that relationships should be a bit more organic. But actually, when you drill into that, it's a bit silly, because ultimately, you know, everyone you meet, you initially meet them as a kind of stranger. And, you know, yeah, so I don't have any kind of principled objection to using an app. I know lots of people who have got wonderful relationships and marriages and families as a result of Christian Connection, or Salt, I believe, is the one the kids are using these days. I think it's certainly, if I was on the apps and actively looking for a partner, I would be, some questions I'd want to ask myself about how do you kind of cultivate the right attitude to that approach, and you know, ensure that, you know, we're not idolizing relationships or kind of putting too much effort into finding a partner above everything else in our kind of our life. As good as getting married is, it's not the only thing. And as you know, we've mentioned before, and there's podcast, I'm sure, about the kind of the need for Christians to kind of re-engage with the virtues of singleness. And I also think there's something specific about apps, different to how kind of old-fashioned analog dating, is that almost by definition, when you're on the apps, you are constantly starting new conversations with different people. It's not expected that you would be kind of exclusively exploring a relationship with one person at a time until you actually have done several kind of in-person dates and both people kind of agree, yes, we're going to focus on seeing if this is there's something here.
Oh, and I so wasn't I think aware of that. Is that actually?
Yeah. So the way it normally works is etiquette. That the etiquette, as far as I understand, I'm not an expert. I mean, dating apps kind of became a thing after I got married. So I'm very much not an expert. My understanding is that, you know, you have a profile, you're exploring, you're swiping around. When you and another person see each other's profile and kind of agree that, yes, you're interested, that then you can start direct messaging them, and you don't go immediately to, right, let's meet next Tuesday evening at this bar and have a drink. The standard premise is that we'll just start chatting. It's just like texting. And so you will be texting this person, seeing, is there any chemistry? Do we have stuff in common? You know, shooting the breeze, testing out, is there a connection here? But there's absolutely no expectation that you wouldn't simultaneously be also messaging other people. And that's not kind of, and there's nothing wrong with that. And in fact, even to the point where you might, it's again, totally normal to be meeting up in person and having an initial second date with this person. And the next week you've got a date plan with someone else. And again, I don't think in principle that's awful, but I just think there is a tension there about how do we go through this process with a sense of kind of integrity and treating people carefully and respectfully and making sure that we're not kind of commodifying the experience of dating. But I appreciate that's an easy thing for me, you know, 10 years married this year, to say to people in their late 20s or 30s who are starting to wonder if they're ever going to kind of meet the right person.
Well, fascinating. I think we'd be very interested in feedback, wouldn't we? If any more comments about, would you ever use a dating app? What are the positives, negatives? And I'd really like to come back in a future episode to some of the deeper issues about patriarchy, the role of men. Is it true, for instance, that the workplace is becoming, quotes, feminized, that feminine characteristics are now much more sought than male, what are traditionally male roles?
And one of the things that you mentioned in passing, Jordan Peterson, and I think it's probably no coincidence that at the same time there is a kind of conversation underway in the church about, you know, we've lost touch with men. It's too, the church, our culture is too feminized and it's off-putting. there is exactly the same conversation happening in the secular world, and figures like Jordan Peterson, who are incredibly, have kind of gathered an army of disaffected young men who feel alienated from their societies, who feel like it's a female-dominated world that I don't fit in, that I don't understand, that I can't navigate, and I'm bitter and angry about this. And so I would just think, just draw attention to the fact, it's an interesting coincidence that this same kind of psychological, social, cultural moment is happening in both the secular world and the church world. But I think it's a really interesting thing about, you know, sometimes called the men's rights movement, this kind of backlash to the kind of presumption that the feminist revolution of the 1960s was an obvious good thing. And yeah, I think it's a really interesting topic because there's a lot of Christians who are interested in this idea and exploring, you know, actually, is modern society bad for men? From can the kind of feminist revolution and the way it's kind of completely overturned our social constructions be harmonized with a kind of Christian account of gender difference? So yeah, looking forward to that conversation in the future podcast.
Great stuff. Well, I think we should draw stumps now, but look forward to chatting again.
Yeah. Thanks everyone for listening. As you said, we're very interested in your feedback, particularly on some of the stuff we've been talking about today. And again, bigger conversation we had about egg freezing and children and childbirth and families in our confusing modern world. So please do get in touch. You can email molad@premier.org.uk. And you can also contact me on Twitter or X, whatever you'd like to call it. I'm at TS Wyatt, TSWYATT. But please do keep your questions coming in. And thanks to John, who's... No, we didn't actually mention that, did I? I'll cut that out. So please do keep your questions coming in, and we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.